I want to begin with some thanks. I want to thank Gabe Day and Kevin Zenzi and all the people who put together this fantastic, fantastic event. And I have a huge vote of thanks to you in the audience for coming, some of you from Atlanta and Baltimore, long, places far, far away. And I want to thank you, above all, for being so diverse. There's so many people here on particular issues I would disagree with, but we have what it is really necessary for a movement to get started in this country, which is not to draw from a tiny bit of the political spectrum, but to have issues which draw people together from all corners of the spectrum, and specifically from left and right, and that is clearly what's happening here today. In the last chapter of my last published prose book, The Road to 9/11, I sketched out my hope for America, which was a coalition of left and right with a spiritual base, believing in a better future, a better alternative for what we have now. I gave the example of Poland and Solidarity, which was, you know, at the beginning, a very unlikely coalition of abortionists and anti-abortionists, of people who believed in the church and people who didn't believe in God at all. And they somehow all came together and pushed the Soviet army out of Poland, which was quite an amazing thing to do, actually. If they could push out the Soviet army, maybe we can do something about the war machine in Washington. And this conference is also especially meaningful for me in another way, because I am also a poet, and I also write about spiritual matters, and a number of people have been coming up to me and saying, I like your poetry, or I liked the talk you gave on Thomas Merton, which was my big effort last year. Not everybody has to be one of those people, but the fact that those people are here too, I feel the dichotomy in my life between my left brain and my right brain is somehow being healed by the presence of people here. I gave a talk on Friday night about the poetry of Czesław Miłosz, who was one of the three inspirations for the Solidarity movement in Poland, and it's a kind of poetic version of the last chapter of my book, so Road to 9/11. So if you liked that chapter in the Road to 9/11, check out my poetry too. All right. Today's talk is, I think, what I want to talk about is continuity of government planning. Is there anyone in this room who does not know what I'm talking about when I say continuity of government planning? Well, there are a few. Well, so at least some of you are going to hear something you didn't know about before. This is what I think should be an immediate priority objective for action that the left and the right can agree about, which is the hijacking of our Constitution by a secret group that we still don't know even who they were, except for two of them, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. So let me begin my talk now. In July 1987, first the title, Continuity of Government Planning, the process by which the U.S. Constitution has already been superseded. In July 1987, during the Iran-Contra hearings, grilling of Oliver North, the American public got a glimpse of a, quote, highly sensitive, close quote, secret that North had been involved in emergency plans to suspend the American Constitution in the event of a nuclear attack. And I'm going to quote from the hearings. And this was printed the next day in the New York Times, but as you listen to it, you may be interested that not one newspaper ever commented on the content of this interchange. Congressman Jack Brooks from Texas, thank God for Texas. Colonel North, in your work at the NSC, were you not assigned at one time to work on plans for the continuity of government in the event of a major disaster? And then North's lawyer jumped up, Mr. Chairman! And then the senator, Daniel Inouye, who was a Democrat, the chair of the committee, responded in a way that showed he knew exactly what Brooks was referring to. And this is what he said. I believe that that question touches upon a highly sensitive and classified area, so may I request that you not touch on that. Jack Brooks, I was particularly concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I read in Miami papers and several others that there had been a plan developed by that same agency, a contingency plan in the event of emergency, that would suspend the American Constitution. And I was deeply concerned about it and wondered if that was an area in which he had worked. I believe that it was, and I wanted to get his confirmation. Nanonui again, may I most respectfully request that that matter not be touched upon at this stage. If we wish to get into this, I'm certain arrangements can be made for an executive session. End of quote. How many people never knew that happened in Iran-Contra? Well, it sort of freaked us at the time, and then it just disappeared from view. So let me go on. We have never heard if there ever was or was not an executive session, or if the rest of Congress was ever made aware of the matter. Reportedly, Congress as a whole was bypassed altogether. Two books say that Congress was completely left out of this planning, though key individuals may have known. I suspect Lee Hamilton, but I can't prove it. Jack Brooks was responding to a story by Alfonso Chardy in the Miami Herald. Chardy's story alleged that Oliver North was involved with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, in plans to take over federal, state, and local functions during a national emergency. This planning for continuity of government, COG, and that's what I'll say from now on, called for, quote, suspension of the Constitution, turning control of the government over to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, emergency appointment of military commanders to run state and local governments, and declaration of martial law, close quote. To my knowledge, no one in the public, including myself, attached enough importance to the Chardy story. Chardy himself suggested that Reagan's Attorney General, William French Smith, had intervened to stop the COG plan from being presented to the president. 7 years later, in 1994, Tim Weiner reported in the New York Times that what he called the Doomsday Project, the search for, quote, ways to keep the government running after a sustained nuclear attack on Washington, close quote, was going to be closed down and had less than 6 months to live. Technically, Weiner's story may have been correct, but it was also very misleading. On the basis of that report, the first two books on COG planning, by James Bamford and by James Mann, books otherwise excellent and well-informed, reported that COG planning had been abandoned. They were wrong. What they and Weiner did not report was that under Reagan, the purpose of COG planning had been changed. COG plans now called for suspension of the Constitution, not just after a nuclear war, but for any national security emergency. This was defined in Executive Order 12656 of 1988 as, quote, any occurrence, including natural disaster, military attack, technological emergency, or other emergency, that seriously degrades or seriously threatens the national security of the United States. That's the language of the order. In other words, extraordinary emergency measures originally designed for an America devastated in a nuclear attack were now to be applied to anything the White House considered an emergency. This expanded goal was envisaged as early as 1984, when, according to Boston Globe reporter Ross Geldspan, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North was working with officials of FEMA to draw up a secret contingency plan to surveil political dissenters and to arrange for the detention of hundreds of thousands of undocumented aliens in case of an unspecified national emergency. The plan, part of which was codenamed Rex 84, called for the suspension of the Constitution under a number of scenarios, including a U.S. invasion of Nicaragua. Clearly, 9/11 met this definition, any emergency, and we know for a certainty that COG planning was instituted on that day in 2001. What few have recognized is that it is still in effect. The Constitution has indeed been superseded. COG plans are still authorized by a proclamation of emergency that has been extended each year by presidential authority, most recently by President Obama in September 2009. On 9/11, Before the last plane had crashed in Pennsylvania, the White House authorized the institution of COG plans. There is no doubt that it was introduced. The 9/11 report confirms it twice on pages 38 and 326. COG plans are also the probable source for the Patriot Act that appeared from nowhere, and also for the Department of Homeland Security's Project Endgame, a 10-year plan to expand detention camps at a cost of $400 million in fiscal year 2007 alone. Homeland Security once said that it was to handle all the illegal immigrants in this country. Well, there are about 12 million of them, so that is an ambitious plan. And, of course, what will work for immigrants will also work for those political agitators that were being talked about in the Rex 84 plan. The most repressive features of the Bush presidency were apparently all sketched out in COG planning: warrantless surveillance, warrantless detention, even suspension of our right of habeas corpus, first granted by Magna Carta in 1215, all planned long before Bush took office. Much is known about COG plans. Much more is not known. We don't know exactly what is in effect at all. We know that the ultra-secret planning began in the 80s under Reagan and North and continued under George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. Two of the key planners on the secret planning committee were Cheney and Rumsfeld, the two men who implemented it under 9/11, even though when Clinton was president, both men, both Republicans, were heads of major corporations and were not even in the government at all. So we should not be surprised that with implementation came the warrantless detentions that Oliver North had planned for two decades earlier, the warrantless eavesdropping that is their logical counterpart, and the militarization of the domestic United States under a new military command, NORTHCOM. Through NORTHCOM, the U.S. Army now is engaged with local law enforcement to control America in the same way that through CENTCOM it is engaged with local law enforcement to control Afghanistan and Iraq. We have now become a military district where the Army operates the suspension in effect of the Posse Comitatus Acts, which restricted it from doing this until the COG planning was implemented. We learned that COG planning was still active in 2007 when President Bush issued National Security Presidential Directive 51, NSPD 51. This, for the sixth time, extended for 1 year the emergency proclaimed on September 14, 2001, and empowered the president to personally ensure continuity of government in the event of any catastrophic emergency. Bush announced that NSPD 51 contains classified continuity annexes which shall, quote, be protected from unauthorized disclosure. Under pressure from his 9/11 truth constituents, Congressman Peter DeFazio of the Homeland Security Committee twice requested to see these annexes. The second time in a written letter signed by the chair of his committee, the Homeland Security Committee. His request was denied. They did not have the clearances to see the annexes. Now, the National Emergencies Act, one of the post-Watergate reforms that Vice President Cheney so hated, specifies that, this is in the U.S. statutes, not later than 6 months after a national emergency is declared, and not later than the end of each six-month period thereafter that such emergency continues, each House of Congress shall meet to consider a vote on a joint resolution to determine whether that emergency shall be terminated. It's not that they can do it, may do it. They are required by law to do it. Yet in 9 years, Congress has not once met to discuss the state of emergency declared by George W. Bush in response to 9/11, a state of emergency which remains in effect today. Appeals to the Congress to meet its responsibilities to review COG have fallen on deaf ears. Former Congressman Dan Hamburg and I appealed publicly last year, both to Obama to terminate the emergency and to Congress to hold the hearings required of them by statute. But Obama, without discussion, extended the 9/11 emergency again on September the 10th, 2009. There was actually a press conference and some other minor thing was discussed. This was not mentioned or discussed in the press conference. And Congress has continued to ignore its statutory obligations. One congressman explained to a constituent that the provisions of the National Emergencies Act have now been rendered inoperative. How? By COG. If true, this would seem to justify Chardy's description of COG as suspension of the Constitution. Are there other parts of the Constitution that have been suspended? We do not know. And Congress has been told it cannot find out. Now, I don't know if it's my background as a Canadian, Karen, that leads me so focused on this legal question of COG. Plans drafted by a secret committee, including corporation heads not in the government, have provided rules that override public law and the separation of powers that is at the heart of the Constitution. Congress is derelict in addressing this situation. Even Congressman Kucinich, the one congressman I have met, will not answer my communications on this subject. What offends me most is that America has become a country where a group of men, including some not even in the government, were able to plan successfully for the imposition of these secret rules. As I see it, the only authorization for the COG planning was a secret decision by President Reagan, NSD 55 of September 14, 1982, which happens to be the same day in which the emergency was proclaimed 19 years later, which in effect federalized the counterinsurgency planning called Cable Splicer, which Reagan had authorized in California when he was governor there. I submit that the planning by Cheney, Rumsfeld, and others in the last two decades was not confined to a response to an emergency. The 1,000-page Patriot Act, which was dropped on Congress as promptly as the Tonkin Gulf resolution had been back in 64, is still with us from day to day. Congress has never seriously challenged it, and Obama quietly signed a one-year extension of three controversial sections of it on February 27th of this year. Now, we should not forget that the Patriot Act was only passed after lethal anthrax letters were mailed to two crucial Democratic senators, Senators Daschle and Leahy, who had been questioning it and who subsequently reversed their initial opposition to the bill after receiving the anthrax letters. Someone, we still do not know who, must have planned those anthrax letters well in advance. This is a fact most Americans do not want to think about. Someone also must have planned the new instructions on June 1, 2001, determining that military interceptions of hijacked aircraft had to be approved at the, quote, highest levels of government. This meant, in practice, in fact, on that day, Cheney and Rumsfeld, because Bush was in a plane circling over the southern United States that had lost its communications system with the rest of the government. The report attributes this order to a JCS memo of June 1, 2001, entitled Aircraft Piracy and Destruction of Derelict Airborne Objects. But there was no such written requirement before June 1, 2001, and I am informed that it was quietly revoked in December 2001. They went back to the old system where, if a plane went off course, it was just a matter of routine for jets to take up. Intercept doesn't mean shoot it down. It means just gets on the wings. That now had to be approved by Cheney and Rumsfeld. And, well, you know, most of you know what a mess all of that was on 9/11. In the road to 9/11, I suggest that the change in the JCS memo came from the National Preparedness Review, in which President Bush, in May of 2001, authorized Vice President Cheney, together with, guess who, FEMA, to tackle the task of dealing with terrorist attacks, close quote. Not noticed by the press was the fact that Cheney and FEMA had already been working on COG planning as a team throughout the 1980s and 1990s. Not just the mainstream press, but even excellent authors like James Bamford and James Mann have underestimated the enormity of what happened. Let me quote again from my book, The Road to 9/11. In April 1994, Tim Weiner announced in the New York Times that in the post-Soviet Clinton era, the Doomsday Project, as it was known, was to be closed. Weiner added that while some continuity of programs continue under the aegis of Pentagon planners, they are pale versions of the vision laid out by Reagan in 83. They are realizing these requirements are throwbacks to the Cold War, nuclear analyst Bruce Blair said. They are not relevant to today's world. This article persuaded authors James Mann and James Bamford that Reagan's COG plans had now been abandoned because, quote, there was, it seemed, no longer any enemy in the world capable of decapitating America's leadership, close quote. In fact, however, only one phase of COG planning had been terminated, a Pentagon program for response to a nuclear attack. Instead, according to author Andrew Coburn in his biography of Rumsfeld, a new target was found. And now a long quote from Coburn. Although the exercises continued, still budgeted at over $200 million a year in the Clinton era, the vanished Soviets were now replaced by terrorists. Exactly. There were other changes, too. In the earlier times, a specialist selected to run the shadow government had been drawn from across the political spectrum, Democrats and Republicans alike. But now, down in the bunkers, Rumsfeld found himself in politically congenial company, the players' roster being filled almost exclusively with Republican hawks. Quote, it was one way for these people to stay in touch. They'd meet, do the exercise, but also sit around and castigate the Clinton administration in the most extreme way, close quote, a former Pentagon official with direct knowledge of the phenomenon told me, that is to say Coburn. Quote, again, the official, you could say this was a secret government in waiting. The Clinton administration was extraordinarily inattentive. The Clinton government had no idea what was going on, close quote. Now, Coburn's account requires some qualification. Richard Clark, a Clinton Democrat, makes it clear that he participated in the COG games in the 1990s, and indeed he himself drafted Clinton's Presidential Decision Directive 67 on enduring constitutional government and continuity of government. But COG planning involved different teams for different purposes. I suspect that the Pentagon official was describing the Department of Defense team dealing with retaliation to a terrorist attack. The Pentagon official's description of a, quote, secret government in waiting, close quote, which included both Cheney and Rumsfeld, who were indeed waiting, is very close to the standard definition of a cabal, as a group of persons secretly united to bring about a change of government. In the same era, Cheney and Rumsfeld projected change also by their public lobbying through the Project for the New American Century for a more militant Middle East policy. In light of how COG was actually implemented in 2001, one can legitimately suspect that however interested this group had been in continuity of government under Reagan, under Clinton, the focus of Cheney's and Rumsfeld's COG planning, the focus was now a change of government. Understandably, there is great psychological resistance to the extraordinary claim that Cheney and Rumsfeld, even when not in government, were able to help plan successfully for constitutional modifications which they themselves then implemented when back in power. Most people cannot bring themselves even to believe the second known half of this claim, that on September the 11th, 2001, two COG plans overriding the Constitution were indeed implemented. That is why the first two print reviews of my book, The Road to 9/11, which were both favorable, both intelligently written, both reported that I had speculated that COG had been imposed on 9/11. No, it was not a speculation. The 9/11 Commission report twice confirms that COG was instituted on the basis of a phone call between Bush and Cheney, of which the Commission could find no record. No record, I did speculate in my book, because it took place on a secure COG telephone outside the presidential bunker with such a high classification that the 9/11 Commission was never supplied the phone records. A footnote in the 9/11 report says, the 9/11 crisis tested the government's plans and capabilities to ensure the continuity of constitutional government and the continuity of government operations. We did not investigate this topic, except as needed to understand the activities and communications of key officials on 9/11, which in this respect they did not understand and admitted they did not. The chair, vice chair, and senior staff, that's Lee Hamilton again, were briefed on the general nature and implementation of these continuity plans. The other footnotes confirm that no information from COG files was used to document the 9/11 report. At a minimum, these files might resolve the mystery of the missing phone call which authorized COG. I suspect that they might tell us a great deal more, such as the exercises that took place on that day. What is the first step out of this current state of affairs in which the Constitution has in effect been superseded by a higher, if less legitimate, authority? I submit that it is to get Congress to do what the law requires and determine whether our present proclamation of emergency shall be terminated as required under 50 U.S.C. 1622, paragraph 2002. That's the part of the U.S. Code which requires this. An earlier, polite, judiciously worded appeal to this effect failed. It may be necessary to raise the issue in a larger, albeit more controversial context, the scandal that a small cabal was able to supersede the Constitution and Congress has failed despite repeated requests to do anything about it. And that's what I hope left and right in this room can agree on, that something should be done to restore our Constitution to the effect that it was in before 2001. I don't know what the situation is. I know that a congressman tried to find out what the situation is and was told that he didn't have the authority to do so, even though he and the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee were requesting this in writing. They don't know, I don't know, but we know there are COG annexes being added to. The latest we know of were added in 2007. Yes, they are still in force. I was very interested in Ellen Brown's talk this morning because I feel that she was absolutely right to draw an analogy between the unknown forces which engineered the fall of Lehman Brothers and the unknown forces which engineered 9/11. And I wanted to ask her, because at one point she said that all these bankers were doing what seemed best to them, but at another point she really seemed to be implying that the system had been gamed by some sinister force in order to bring about a profound economic change. And that is what I see myself, though I can't prove it, as there was a similar political gaming on the 9/11 2001 side to bring around this change in COG. The most important part, which I haven't developed in this talk, but I write about it in The Road to 9/11, was this project endgame of the Department of Homeland Security to provide a whole new system of detention camps. And the justification for it is almost exactly the justification for the camps that North was working on back in the 1980s, in other words, to deal with the problem of illegal immigrants. But, of course, the detention camps are fungible. They can be used for us as well as for illegal immigrants. And the other thing is NORTHCOM. That was done with almost no debate at all. And by the way, it was also done in my country, Canada. Britain went through a very similar convulsion almost immediately after 9/11. And then Canada has militarized itself. An American army can now march into Canada, or more likely fly into Canada, without any authorization from the civilian government of Canada because of this NORTHCOM, NORAD planning, which is escaping from civilian review. So all of this concerns me very much, but I can't answer your question. We just know there's something out there, it's big, and nobody's talking about it. And the great disappointment was that we got a Democratic president. He's not committed to the Bush agenda. He did not vote for going into Iraq. But he's extending the cloak of secrecy about this. That's very disturbing, I think.